Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about faith, family, freedom, the state of Illinois, our nation, and conservative action. Here's David Smith and Monty Larrick.
During this special edition of Illinois Family Spotlight, we go back to 2011 and the Illinois Family Institute's Marriage Symposium in Arlington Heights. One of the keynote speakers for that event was Lori Higgins, IFI's cultural affairs writer. While her comments at the symposium were recorded several years before the Supreme Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, they are important for today. And her insights offer a preview of what marriage and families will look like in the future without a strong Christian response to the normalization of homosexuality and same-sex marriage. A note, Lori refers to Dr. Michael Brown a couple of times during her address. Dr. Brown is the host of the syndicated radio talk show The Line of Fire and was another speaker at the IFI Marriage Symposium. Here's Lori Higgins.
Conservatives have two central problems in regard to both the issue of the normalization of homosexuality in the culture in general and with the same-sex marriage issue. Those problems are cowardice and lack of knowledge or lack of understanding, which is, I think, both of those have been addressed today. Our lack of knowledge actually contributes to our cowardice, or what I say is our unbiblical unwillingness to endure persecution. You'd asked a question about how to get people from your church involved, someone asked over there. I think we have to be willing to even have our friends and churches be irritated with us when we're speaking the truth, and we have to be persistent. There's no magic formula for getting our church leaders to be engaged on this. We have to send them material, we have to talk to them, ask for social concerns committees, things like that. But it's a, you know, Michael was saying, it's a horrible battle. There's nothing, the abortion thing, issue, it's of paramount importance. It's not as hard to be on the pro-life side anymore. This is the battle, and Christians are Johnny-come-latelys to difficult cultural issues. Historically, we were in Germany. We didn't stand behind Bonhoeffer. We didn't stand behind William Wilberforce when he was fighting slavery. We didn't stand behind Martin Luther King. So we have to be willing to endure being hated and persecuted and maybe lose jobs. Michael brought up Frank Turek. Maybe some of you, I recently wrote about it. He was hired as a consultant for Cisco Systems in California. They found out that he had written a book about homosexuality and they canceled his contracts, they didn't renew them. And I think he lost another one with maybe Bank of America. If we don't know how to think through the arguments used to promote same-sex marriage, we become either persuaded by them or we don't feel comfortable engaging with our friends and our neighbors and our family members and our colleagues, our elected representatives and our church leaders. So I want to address briefly some of the specious arguments commonly encountered in the culture that I think we all need to be prepared to respond to. First, what is homosexuality? And I know this seems like a silly question, but it's really the foundational question upon which the whole homosexuality-affirming movement is built, and about which I believe many conservatives are confused. I would argue that there are very broadly two categories of existential human conditions. First, there are conditions like race and biological sex, which we're going to just assume that we all know what that is for purposes of this. These are conditions that are 100% heritable, completely immutable in all cases, and have no behavioral manifestations that are legitimate to assess morally. For example, having brown skin has no behavioral and therefore no moral implications. And then there's a second category of conditions, which includes conditions that are constituted by subjective feelings and volitional behavior, voluntary behaviors. This would include polyamory. Someone mentioned that. If you don't know what that is, it's being romantically and sexually attracted to and involved with multiple people at the same time. It's different from polygamy because it's not just a man and women, it could be three men and two women in a relationship. So this category of conditions would include polyamory, it would include adult consensual incest, and homosexuality. The initial impulses or desires may be shaped by biological factors, we don't know. But the behaviors associated with these conditions are volitional and are legitimate objects of moral assessment. Liberals are plucking homosexuality out of the second category and treating it like it's conditions from the first category, and they offer no justification for it. So when you hear people making endless comparisons of homosexuality to race, they do it with bans on interracial marriage. It's based on that same flawed analogy. When have you ever heard a conservative say, what's your evidence that it's biologically determined like race? We never put them on the offensive, on the defensive, as they do with us, and we need to start asking those questions. And I think even if biological factors were to be found that predispose someone for homosexual attraction, would not mean that homosexual acts are inherently moral. We shouldn't be afraid of the science on this. Science tells us nothing about morality. I don't believe that people choose to experience same-sex attraction. I believe they choose how to respond to those unchosen and, in many cases, unwanted attractions. Those who experience same-sex attraction are no different from any other person who experiences unwanted, powerful, persistent desires or attractions. Our task as moral beings is to determine which of our myriad impulses are morally legitimate to act upon. From this attempt to equate homosexuality with race emerges the claim that disapproval of homosexuality is equivalent to racism or to hatred of persons. And our ideological opponents argue that hatred or ignorant bias is the sole basis for opposing same-sex marriage. Their flawed thinking then becomes the impetus for destroying the institution of marriage. But homosexuality is not analogous to race, and therefore disapproval of homosexuality is not analogous or equivalent to racism. Instead, disapproval of homosexuality is equivalent to disapproval of other conditions that are centrally defined by volitional acts like polyamory. Furthermore, homosexualists, I'm going to use that term, it's not my term, I think Rob Gagnon maybe came up with it, but they're homosexuals and those who agree with their beliefs and goals. They don't apply their principle consistently. They don't argue that disapproval of other volitional behaviors constitutes hatred of persons. For example, many people say polygamy is immoral, and yet no one who believes this is ever accused of hating polygamists. That's a strategy to accuse us of hating them. Robert George, he's a Princeton law professor, has said in an interview, their strategy works because we allow it to work. If I were silenced every time someone said something horrible about me, I wouldn't be up here doing this. It works because we let it work. And few people say that opposition to polygamy is a discriminatory practice that grows out of hatred. One fallacious argument, and this has definitely been touched upon, I hope I'm not too redundant here, people don't understand why the government is involved in marriage. It's a private institution concerned solely with the romantic and sexual feelings of the parties involved. That's the argument out there. I think there are even conservatives who believe that. If or when private actions or relationships have no impact on the public good, the government should remain uninvolved. If, however, private actions or relationships impact the public and are adjudged harmful, society is not only entitled but obligated to legislate. The reason that our government provides for the legal recognition of any marital union is that society understands that through such unions, the private impacts the public. Historically, society has determined that since marriage is fundamental to the health of society, it's the right and responsibility of society collectively. We don't really define it. We recognize, regulate, promote, and protect marriage. The fact that society has made mistakes and included a criterion that was not fundamental to marriage, that is, with race, when we had bans on interracial marriage, does not mean that society has been wrong on all criteria. Tradition, sociology, psychology, and religion, multiple religions, in fact, have held that both men and women are crucial to the fulfillment of children's needs, and the fulfillment of children's needs is crucial to the health of society. If marriage were solely a private institution that was concerned only with the subjective feelings of individuals, and if it had no impact on the public good, then there would be no justifiable reason for the government to be involved at all. And if society decides it is exclusively a private institution that is concerned only with feelings, subjective feelings of individuals, there is no justification for prohibiting plural marriages, or actually any kind of marriages, incestuous marriages equally.
Lori Higgins, during the Illinois Family Institute's 2011 Marriage Symposium in Arlington Heights, will continue with her speech after this short break.
Have you ever noticed how many churches sit empty throughout the week? Well, Freedom Project Academy wants to change that, and it's a simple concept. Partner with churches across the country to provide fully accredited, biblically based online classes that allow every church that sits empty Monday through Friday to start their own school. Let's fill up our churches all week long. Visit Freedom Project Academy because together we can faithfully educate America.
This is David Davenport of the Hoover Institution for Townhall.com. As America's students go back to school this month, America's schools need to go back to civic education. Our schools are awash in political concerns, from guns to immigration to bathrooms even. But it's not clear that students have a good understanding of politics, history, and civics. In the last round of national testing, a pitiful 18% were proficient in history, 23% in government. And these are the future leaders of our republic. With the emphasis on math and science and pervasive political correctness, schools are not teaching basic civics. Both instructional time and testing of government and history are down. A few states are beginning to act, adding civic education courses and testing. But more must be done. Preparing students to become good citizens and voters is more important than ever, and that requires a major commitment to civic education. I'm David Davenport.
Thanks for making Illinois Family Spotlight part of your day. Let's continue with a speech that Lori Higgins gave during the 2011 Illinois Family Institute Marriage Symposium in Arlington Heights. Lori is the cultural affairs writer for IFI, and during this portion of her address at the symposium, Lori weighed in on parenting, marriage as a civil right, homosexuality being presented as normative in public schools, and how will same-sex marriage affect society. Here's Lori.
One question that should be posed to those homosexuals and their allies who say that the definition of marriage should allow homosexuals to marry but remain restricted to just two people is exactly what Michael said. Why just two people? If it's not intrinsically connected to procreation, which doesn't mean that every marriage produces children, but that marriage as a government-recognized institution, if it weren't intrinsically connected to procreation, why would you limit it to two people? And ask that of your friends who disagree with you. They'll have an answer. The government is concerned with what best serves the continued health of our nation and what best serves the future of any civilization is the next generation. What best serves the needs of the next generation, that is to say children, is being raised when possible, if they're fit, by the biological parents who produce them, which brings up the issue of children's rights. I think Michael touched on this. And it almost never comes up. I never read this in any articles where they're promoting same-sex marriage. Children have inherent, inalienable rights to have relationship with, be raised by their biological, natural parents. When homosexuals claim that they desire only members of their own sex as romantic and sexual partners, they are tacitly acknowledging the truth that men and women are fundamentally and significantly different. Many, including experts in the fields of sociology, psychiatry, psychology, theology, and neuroscience, assert that these differences are anatomical, biological, emotional, psychological, and spiritual in nature. Since men and women are fundamentally and significantly different, unions composed of the same sex must necessarily be of a different nature from unions composed of different sexes, and therefore it's reasonable to conclude that each type of union would impact society differently. Further, society has concluded that the only type of union that truly benefits the public is a union between two unmarried adults of opposite sexes who are not closely related by blood. In evaluating the inherent contributions to the public good that homosexual unions bring, I'm not talking about homosexual people, unions, society has concluded that legal recognition is not warranted. When addressing the question of whether to fundamentally change the legal definition of marriage, the issue of the effectiveness of same-sex couples to parent often arises. Proponents of same-sex marriage argue that homosexuals are equally able to love and provide for children as heterosexuals. What's curious about this argument is that it seems to tacitly acknowledge a connection between marriage and child rearing, even while promoting the legal recognition of a type of relationship that is naturally and by design sterile. This question also raises an issue that we don't have time to discuss this evening about whether two men or two women can as well provide for the psychosocial needs of children as a sexually complementary relationship. If the capacity for loving and providing for children were the only criteria necessary for parental fitness, then society should support the legalization of marriage and adoption for polyamorous or incestuous couples, for surely there are polyamorists and brother-sister couples who are capable of loving and providing for children. Historically, however, criteria for parental fitness have included not merely the capacity of adults to love and provide for children. Criteria for parental fitness included an evaluation of the moral nature of the relationship between parents. In a wiser, less relativistic culture, this criterion did not need to be explicitly articulated. It would go without saying that the government would not legally recognize unions defined by inherently morally flawed relationships like polygamous, incestuous, and homosexual relationships, regardless of the ability of the parents to provide for those children. Making judgments about the morality of homosexuality is no more unethically discriminatory than is making judgments about the morality of polyamory or adult consensual incest. Once government jettisons an evaluation of the inherent morality of the relationships between or among those seeking to marry, there is no rational reason to prohibit polyamorous or incestuous couples from marrying. Some argue that marriage is a civil right, but is it? Homosexualists assert that marriage is a civil right to which homosexuals are entitled, ignoring, however, the fact that as it now stands, all unmarried adults enjoy the right and privilege to marry, even homosexuals. They simply do not have the right to redefine marriage unilaterally. Marriage is a pre-political institution, which means marital relationships exist. The relationship between men and women that usually results in children simply exists, and the government is recognizing it. Moreover, access to marriage is not a civil right. Our civil rights are very specific rights that are accorded to individuals because of their status as humans. Civil rights are not accorded to couples, but rather to individual persons. These rights are based on universal, objective characteristics, not based on subjective individual feelings, desires, orientations, preferences, or volitional conduct. Civil rights are not simply all things that we find desirable. You'll hear that in the culture. Every time there's something that someone wants, they say, that's my civil right to have it. Our civil rights include the following: freedom of religion, speech, the press, assembly, the right to life, and freedom from involuntary servitude. Homosexuals are not demanding a civil right that is denied them based on a universal objective characteristic. They are being denied the right to redefine the institution of marriage by eliminating one of the criteria that society has recognized as essential, sexual complementarity. Marriage is an institution, and access to it is not a civil right. The government can legitimately define an institution and limit its membership in accordance with that definition. Homosexuals as individuals are not being denied the right to marry. They are being denied the right to choose the sex of their marriage partner. Others are denied the right to choose the numbers of their partners. Still others are denied the right to choose the age of their partner, and others are denied the right to choose the blood proximity of their partner. None of these groups are being denied their civil rights, even though they cannot marry whom they'd like to marry. They are being prevented from unilaterally redefining marriage, which is a public institution that affects the public good. Most of these groups, with the exception of pedophiles, are free to pursue emotional intimacy, engage in sexual relationships, and set up households together. Society, however, is under no moral obligation to provide legal recognition of these relationships simply because those involved experience love and sexual attraction. I'm sure you've all heard the foolish question that is often posed to us, well, how will same-sex marriage hurt your marriage? Legalizing same-sex marriage may not hurt any particular existing marriage, but that's of no relevance to the question of whether same-sex marriage should be legalized. The relevant and critical question is, will legalized same-sex marriage affect American society? One could similarly pose the argument that the legalization of polygamy would not harm my particular marriage, or even the legalization of an adult consensual incestuous marriages would not affect my marriage. But ultimately, the disuniting of marriage from procreation and marriage from gender will affect society. So how will society be affected? First, those who demand legalized polygamy, legalized incestuous marriages, and a reduction in the legal marrying age will have a precedent to use in their quests to marry the people or the person whom they love. Second, as studies have shown, in those countries that have legalized same-sex unions, heterosexual marriages decline. David Blankenhorn, I think Austin mentioned him, he wrote a book, very important book, I think, called The Future of Marriage. He explains that there will likely be lower marriage rates, higher rates of divorce and non-marital cohabitation, and more children raised outside of marriage and separated from at least one of their natural parents. Once societies sever marriage from gender, procreation, and child rearing, its cultural value diminishes and it becomes meaningless as a cultural institution. Therefore, even heterosexuals become less invested in it. Third, public and eventually private schools would be required when teaching about families to include resources about and descriptions of families led by homosexuals. Schools, including elementary schools, will be compelled to include homosexual identities and family structures as normative in curricula. Fourth, fundamental First Amendment speech and religious rights will be diminished. Former Georgetown University law professor, and she's now member of the EEOC, Kai Feldblum, and she's a lesbian, delivered a paper in about 2005 or 6 at a symposium in which she said, when same-sex marriages are legalized, conservative people of faith will lose religious rights. And she said the legalization of same-sex marriage is necessary and inevitable. She said it's a zero-sum game. The gains for homosexuals are going to be losses for conservative people of faith. She thinks it's justifiable. Fifth, the view that sexual fidelity is an integral aspect of marital commitment will diminish. Whereas sexual fidelity is an indispensable, integral part of the traditional view of marriage, for many, particularly homosexual men, sexual fidelity is neither expected nor desired. Sixth, legalized same-sex marriage will increase ethically dubious ways of creating families, surrogacy, pregnancies resulting from sperm and egg donations or sales, and in vitro fertilization would increase. Seventh, the false idea will spread that fulfillment of emotional and sexual desires constitutes the fundamental basis for marriage. Eighth, the false idea will spread that same-sex unions are equal to heterosexual unions in their potential to affect children and society positively. And finally, the false idea will spread that same-sex unions are equal in moral value to heterosexual unions. We can bring about change, but it will require the difficult task of becoming informed and the even more difficult task of bold public engagement. If we don't do this, marriage will suffer, children will suffer, and our culture will continue to decline. I'm an eternal optimist. I think we can do it.
The Illinois Family Institute's Lori Higgins at the IFI Marriage Symposium in Arlington Heights back in 2011. You can read Lori's informative articles on the IllinoisFamily.org homepage. A reminder, the Illinois Family Institute's Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet is October 5th. Our keynote speaker is George Barna, one of the most influential Christian leaders in America today. For tickets, visit IllinoisFamily.org or call 708-781-9328. And please support the work of the Illinois Family Institute. All donations are tax deductible. Also, tell a friend about Illinois Family Spotlight. Thanks for listening. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening to Illinois Family Spotlight. For more information, please visit us at ifiaction.org and look for us on Facebook and Twitter. If you would like to email us questions or comments, please do so at feedback@ifiaction.org. Until next time, stay engaged and keep your eyes on the prize.